Here is your Radio Theater Channel weekly podcast. The RTC features only the best OTR on our live stream, where we also invite you to tune in and enjoy the Radio Book Channel and the RTC Music Channel, all found at oldtimeradiolisten.com.
Welcome one and all to the Radio Theater Channel's weekly podcast, where we feature old-time radio programs that are popular and sometimes not so popular, but I think you'll enjoy them just the same. We're going to start off with one that may not be so familiar. It's called Behind the Mic, from 1941, and it's a show about radio. And this is called Impersonations of Famous People.
Radio's own show, Behind the Mic. Radio. With a switch of a dial, radio brings you tragedy, comedy, entertainment, information, education, a whole world at your command. But there are stories behind radio, stories behind your favorite programs and favorite personalities, and radio people you never hear of. Stories as amusing, dramatic, and interesting as any make-believe stories you hear on the air. And that's what we give you, the human interest, the glamour, the tragedy, the comedy, and information that are behind the mic. Now, presenting a man whose name has been a symbol of the best in radio since the beginning of broadcasting, Graham McNamee.
Thank you, Gilbert Mack, and good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This afternoon, Behind the Mic first presents a return engagement of mimic Arthur Boran, who tells you just how he does his impersonations of famous people. We present the sound effect of the week, and then you will hear the story behind the weird music on the Inner Sanctum program as told by organist Lou White and your host, Raymond. Next, you will hear an oddity in radio about orchestra leader Fred Fradkin. We salute a program you loved, one that featured the voice of delightful Hollis Shaw. We present Mike Scoops, and finally a dramatic story behind the escape of an actress from occupied France, the thrilling story as told by herself. Last week we had as a guest on Behind the Mic one of radio's ace mimics, Arthur Boran. We thought that you might be interested in hearing, for probably the first time, exactly how a radio impersonator goes about developing his impersonations. And here's Arthur Boran, featured on NBC's Vaudeville Theater of the Air, to tell us all about it. Arthur?
Hello, Graham.
Arthur, do you find it difficult to do imitations?
No, Graham. Frankly, I find myself imitating anything I'm impressed with. A noise, a person. I once even heard a beautiful moo from a cow. You wouldn't believe this, but I went around mooing for weeks until one day a farmer came over and wanted to milk me.
Well, seriously, Arthur, exactly how do you go about learning how to impersonate somebody?
I do it, Graham, by analyzing the voice of the person I'm trying to imitate. The first thing I do is to get the voice level.
What do you mean, get a voice level?
Well, take Eddie Cantor, if I'm going to imitate Cantor. The first thing I do is gradually raise my voice and experiment like this. Congratulate me, Jimmy. It's my wedding anniversary. To celebrate the occasion, I'm wearing the suit I got married in. You see, at the finish, I raised my voice to the level of Cantor's voice. That's just about it.
Yeah, I was glad you got up there. It's a sort of a tenor voice, isn't it?
That's right. Then the next thing I do is to study the peculiarities of the voice inflections and the vocal characteristics and intonations. For instance, take Eddie Cantor again.
I'll take Cantor's salary. You can take Eddie.
And speaking of my salary, Graham, I'll have you understand my income goes into six figures.
Do you mean in income tax?
No, in Ida and my five daughters. Ha ha, ha ha. You see, Cantor's Pepe's voice frequently rises and falls, and he appears to draw a lot of his words from the front of his mouth to the back of his throat, like this. Harry! Harry!
Well, suppose you analyze somebody else's voice for us. How about Lionel Barrymore?
Well, let us say I want to imitate Lionel Barrymore doing a scene from a picture in which he's an attorney pleading with the governor of the state to pardon a condemned young man, and he talks like this.
Come on, Tom, and sign that pardon. And give that mother back a son. And give this country back our good citizen.
Now, I find that Lionel's voice has a great deal of light and shade to it, high and low register. Notice.
Now I know the judge found him guilty, Tom, but he's only a figurehead. It was an accident, I tell you.
He also has a certain rhythm in his speech, about three dots and a dash, like this. Dee-dee-dee-da. Dee-dee-dee-da. For example,
those people out there want to know what you were going to do.
Well, you're right about one thing. Barrymore's voice does go up and down a lot, doesn't it?
Yes, in direct contrast to, let us say, Charles Boyer, whose voice has no range, is baritone in quality, and has no light and shade at all. In fact, it's almost a monotone, like this.
Gentlemen, you don't know who I am. Well, I don't blame you, but someday you shall hear of me.
Well, how could you analyze a voice like Charles Lawton's?
Well, Lawton's voice is one of tenor quality. It has about an octave and a half range, Graham. There's a slight British accent. He has a definite punch attack at the beginning of a sentence, fading away from a shout to that of practically a whisper, like this.
Master Christian, come here. Mutiny on the bounty, eh? Well, a captain's a captain, a seaman's a seaman, and also the lowest form of animal life. I'll live to see the day when you and your band of dirty mutineers are flogged and hanged from the highest yardarm in the King's Navy.
Well, well, blimey down. Well, his voice has a lot of light and shade in it, too, hasn't it?
Yes, quite in contrast to another character who also speaks with a slight accent and whose voice is a mild monotone. Peter Lorre is Mr. Moto.
Charlie, don't get excited, Charlie. We'll solve the mystery. There is an old Chinese proverb which says no disguise can long conceal the truth.
Well, Arthur, what do you think is your best imitation?
Well, I think my best imitation is one I'm going to do right now.
What is it, Arthur?
An imitation of the Invisible Man. I shall now disappear.
Well, wait a minute. Before you do, let me say thank you, Arthur Varan, for a grand story, Behind the Mimic.
Thank you, Graham.
The sound effect of the week. From time to time, Behind the Mic presents some unusual sound effect. One of the most unusual programs in radio, certainly so far as sound effects are concerned, is Superman, which deals with the adventures of a man to whom practically nothing is impossible. He flies through space without wings. He's so strong he breaks down walls with his bare fist. In short, he's terrific. One of the typical effects used on the Superman program is the sound of Superman breaking down a stone wall with his two bare hands. Here's the sound. That was done by the sound effects department building up a miniature wall out of cobblestones, then banging a baseball bat against two or three at times, and finally pushing over the stones and breaking down the wall, and at the same time playing a record of the crash. That's not only super, that's hooper duper. Anybody who has listened to the Inner Sanctum series of Chillers is aware of the importance of the music in creating moods that makes its audience's hair stand on end. So next we present two guests, Lou White, the organist who writes and plays the music for the Inner Sanctum program, and your host, Raymond, actor Raymond Edward Johnson, who will explain Lou's weird effects. Lou White and your host, Raymond.
Good afternoon, my stout-hearted friends of the Inner Sanctum. This is Raymond, your host, once more. You may come in now, if you dare. Before we begin, a word to those of you who don't frighten easily. It'll be no disgrace if, before we are finished, you find yourself trembling against your will. Yeah, that's how an inner sanctum program sometimes opens. It's cheerful, isn't it?
Well, Lou, suppose you and Raymond show us the different ways in which music is used on the inner sanctum program to create mood.
Well, you see, the music is sometimes used as background. For example, if Boris Karloff, in a jocular mood, has just cut up one or two of his friends, giving us a slice of life in the raw, and if he's bothered by his conscience because he hasn't sliced up three or four more, why, then Lou might play what he calls the dream theme. Like this.
Look at me. I can talk and listen and walk and sing just as you do.
Let me out. Let me out. I'm not mad, you hear? Listen to me. No one has ever paid me any attention. I've been ignored. A failure. But I showed them. I committed the perfect crime. You hear? I committed the perfect crime. I'm not crazy. Let me out. Let me out.
Come out. Well, so that's a dream theme, eh?
Yeah, it sounds more like a nightmare, doesn't it, Graham?
How did you do that, Lou? Tell us.
Well, I laid one hand flat on several keys of the organ like this. At the same time, the other hand runs up and down the keyboard in an entirely different key like this. Put them both together, and they spell not mother,
but murder.
I see. It's playing music in two different keys that gives a peculiar quality to your music. Suppose you give us some other examples of the way music is used to create mood in your program.
Well, in a dramatization of Poe's Merry Tale, The Fall of the House of Usher, there was one droll scene in which a woman thought to be dead had been placed in a coffin in the family vault. Awaking, she rises from the coffin and, dressed in her shroud, walks up a flight of stairs to her brother's bedroom, intending to kill him. You see, he had buried her. Yeah, that's amusing, huh? You see, her walking up the flight of steps was portrayed by the organ like this.
Lou, that's very remarkable. Suppose you explain just how you achieved that effect.
Well, my right hand played eerie chords like this. My left hand pressed keys that simulated the howl of the wind like this. And then I pressed the bass pedals of the organ to make footsteps like this.
In other words, your music was used instead of a mechanical sound effect. There certainly seems to be considerable difference between inner sanctum music and other kinds.
But I think the best way to demonstrate the difference between ordinary music and inner sanctum music is by first playing a well-known tune in the regular way and then playing it in inner sanctum style.
Thank you.
But now, played Inner Sanctum style, it sounds like this.
Thank you, Lou White and Raymond Edward Johnson, for a glimpse into the inner sanctum. Oddities in Radio, offering odd little true behind-the-mic stories that help make radio sometimes amusing, sometimes exasperating, but always interesting to the people in it. This week's oddity, an actual experience of Fred Fradkin, orchestra leader on The Adventures of the Thin Man and many other programs. A few years ago, Fred, who is a most delightful violinist, was concertmeister of the Boston Symphony Orchestra. Every couple of weeks, Fred would drive in from Boston to spend a day or so in New York. And one week, Fred parked his car in a garage in the 90s. And that morning, with just about enough time left to drive back to Boston in time for a concert which was to be broadcast, Fred walked over to the garage.
Say, could you get my car, please? I'm in a hurry.
Where is your car, buddy?
It's parked on the fifth floor.
The fifth floor? I'm awful sorry, but the freight elevator broke down. We can't take any cars down.
But I've got to get my car. Look, I've got to get back to Boston in time for a big concert. I'm with the Boston Symphony Orchestra. We're going to broadcast. There'll be a whole orchestra full of musicians without a concertmaster. I've got to get that car.
Well, buddy, I'll see what I can do about it.
This being an emergency, the manager of the garage called the elevator company, and they sent an emergency crew of 10 men, who then hand-cranked the elevator to lift it up to the fifth floor.
Well, here we are, buddy. That certainly gave us a half hour of trouble, but... Well, we're up here. I never saw 10 guys work so hard in all my life to pull up an elevator. Boy, I wouldn't have done that for anybody, not even you, if you hadn't told me you were in such a tough jam.
Well, I want to thank you very much. Why, you know, if I missed that concert... Wait a second. Let's see, where's my car?
Better make it snappy, bud, if you're going to make that concert. Let's see
well,
now.
Well, it isn't here. I've been robbed.
Robbed? Let's have a look at your garage tickets, buddy.
Yeah. Here it is.
Great jumping horse flesh. No wonder your car isn't here. Your garage is two blocks away.
We in radio believe that radio has a tradition of which it can well be proud. A tradition of good programs that linger fondly in our memory. And so each week, we bring you a star or a part of a program you used to hear, a program you loved. This afternoon, we salute the Alec Templeton program, which in 1939 at one time featured the singing of lovely Hollis Shaw. Hollis, an ever-welcome guest, brings us a song she sang on that show, All the Things You Are, which she introduced on Broadway.
Makes the lonely winter seem long. You are the breathless hush of evening that trembles on the brink of a lovely song. You are the angel that lights the storm. The deep you
is none other than Vivian on the Phil Spitalny Hour of Charm program. Behind the scenes of European broadcasting are some highly dramatic stories. Not only stories about the broadcasts themselves, but about the people who supply news for these broadcasts. And here's Helen Hyatt, commentator on NBC's program, Today's News, who formerly broadcast from France and Spain. She's going to tell you about such a person. Helen Hyatt. Helen, suppose you begin the story.
Well, when I was broadcasting in Paris a year and a half ago, I used a number of stories about refugees who were arriving in the French capital, refugees from the war zone, because at that time Paris wasn't yet under fire. I got a number of these human interest stories from a young Hungarian actress, Gita Sereni. She's only 20 years old. She'd already been a prize pupil at Max Reinhardt's Dramatic School in Vienna. During the war in Paris, she turned from dramatics and had been working for the Auxiliaire Social. That's an organization that took care of refugees. Gita had no nurse's training at all, but she was taking care of children whose parents had been killed by machine guns simply because they flocked around her. Gita didn't leave France when the rest of us did, but stayed all winter caring for all these orphans in occupied France. But Gita, you go on from there.
Well, for some time I've been anxious to get out of occupied France. I was unable to control my tongue, and many times I told Nazi soldiers that I hated them and their cause. They always laughed at me, but eventually I knew I was going to get into trouble. As a Hungarian, I didn't think I would have any difficulty in getting out of the country, and I actually got an exit visa from the German embassy. But when I got to the military authorities, things were different. They made me come back several times, and finally an officer...
Schwester, permission for you to leave has been unfortunately mailed out to your address in the country.
To the Auxiliaire Social?
Yeah. See, here's a list with your name crossed out in red, showing that your visa has been granted. I am very sorry to have caused you this inconvenience, but if you will go to the country, you'll...
I spent several hundred francs for a railroad ticket from occupied France to Madrid, then went back home and found a letter refusing the visa. Well, that really discouraged me. So I went back to Paris the same day to find out what had happened. When I got to the office of the military authority...
Schwester, what can I do for you?
What can you do for me? You told me my visa had been mailed to my address in the country, and when I get there, I find permission has been refused.
Schwester, did you really think that we would let you out of the country when we know that you're engaged to an Englishman?
Well, how did you know that?
We looked up your file in the French Prefecture of Police. I am sorry, but you cannot go.
Well, that's what you think. I want you to know that I'm going anyway.
Anyway? How?
Well, I don't know yet. But I just want you to know that. So in case you catch me, you can't say I double-crossed you.
Good luck, Schwester. But I do not think you will get across.
Then what?
Well, I knew there were certain organizations that help people get across the demarcation line. So I made contact with them. One day, I found myself talking.
Yes, mademoiselle?
Well, I want to get across the border to unoccupied France. I'm anxious to go to America.
Well, that is very difficult. It is very dangerous.
Yes, I know that. But I'm willing to take a chance.
Well, then, it will cost you 20,000 francs.
20,000 francs? I haven't got 20,000 francs. I'll give you 2,000.
2,000? My dear girl, 15,000 would be the least we could possibly do it for.
Look, I might be able to raise 4,000.
Oh, not a sou under 12. That is the very least it would cost.
Well, what happened then, Gita?
Well, we finally settled for 7,000 francs. That's about $150 at the prevailing rate of exchange. For that, a man was to be provided who would guide me through the soldiers guarding the border between occupied and unoccupied France, which is separated by a barbed wire fence. Well, accompanied by the guide, I took a train as near as we safely could to the point where we were going to try to cross. There we picked up another girl who also wanted to cross, and the three of us went on in a donkey cart. It was 10 o'clock on a clear, moonlit night. We left the donkey cart outside a farmhouse 300 yards from a demarcation line and then started for the barbed wire. As we walked along, the guide gave us instructions.
These soldiers have police dogs. We must try to avoid them.
What will we do? Suppose they find us.
Well, then, just stand still. These dogs are trained not to bite unless you move.
Oh, very well. My, what a beautiful moonlit night.
Yes, it is too bad. These soldiers will be able to see us much more easily in the moonlight.
Look, there's the barbed wire fence.
If we can only get over that without being seen.
Oh, on a night as beautiful as this, I don't believe anything could happen.
Listen. The police dogs. Don't move.
They'll find us.
I will drive them away. I have a bucket full of stones. There. Come on. Let us run for that fence.
They haven't the Hunde weggejagt. Fire!
It was the soldiers shouting that we had chased the dogs away. Bullets flew all about us. A girl with us was shot in the shoulder. We climbed over the barbed wire and managed to lift her over. Once over the barbed wire, we of course wanted to hide. The Germans have the right to go 200 yards over the French side. But there was nothing to hide behind except one or two trees. I knew as we stood there that they would find us. About a minute afterwards, two young soldiers came to their side of the barbed wire. I realized that the Edelweiss on their uniforms meant that they were Austrians. I came out quite into the open, walked up to them, and faced them across the barbed wire. I gave them a greeting used by Austrian peasants. Grüß Gott. They just looked. And I said, well, I think we ought to talk a little together. Here's quite frankly what happened. I'm Hungarian, but I was born in Vienna. For 10 months now, I've been taking care of children, nursing them. I'm tired. I want to go to Free France for a rest, and I shall be back here on this very same spot in exactly 2 weeks' time. Will you let me through?
But, how about that other girl?
Oh, she has a husband in Free France and wants to join him. You know that none of us can get authorizations to get there.
And that man?
Oh, he's my uncle. You can see from my face that I want to do nothing bad. Will you let us through?
You will promise to be back in 2 weeks?
Yes, I will.
So, Heil Hitler.
Then the guide and I took a bus, carried the girl to a bus 26 kilometers away, where she was to take, where we were to take the nearest railroad. We walked from 12:30 to 6 in the morning, and both of us fainted when we got to the bus. The girl we carried seemed to be in much better physical condition than we. Well, from then on, it was a question of getting to America, which was difficult, but not nearly so exciting. And that's how I escaped from France.
Well, what are you doing now, Gita?
Well, I'm going to lecture for the school assembly service for junior colleges and high schools throughout the United States and Canada. And I would also like to be a radio actress over here. I was, as Helen said, a student in Europe with Max Reinhardt.
And she's a darn good actress, too, Graham, if you could see her.
I believe she is. Well, here's wishing you the very best of luck in radio, Gita. And thank you, Gita Serini and Helen Hyatt, for a swell story.
Next week, Behind the Mic shows you the important part that telephone lines play in network broadcasting. We bring you more of the glamour, the comedy, and the tragedy that are found behind the mic. This is Graham McNamee speaking. Good afternoon, all.
Behind the Mic is written by Mort Lewis. Original music composed by Ernie Watson, conducted by Zelli. This is the Blue Network of the National Broadcasting Company.
And, of course, the Blue Network of the National Broadcasting Company eventually became known as ABC. Now we have a couple of short programs that were used on radio. Interesting programs all the same. We're going to start off with a sports program, Bill Stern's Sports Newsreel. And this is about Babe Ruth from 1946.
C-O-L-G-A-T-E, Colgate presents Bill Stern.
With a Colgate Shave Cream Sports Newsreel.
Bill Stern, the Colgate Shave Cream Man, is on the air. Bill Stern, the Colgate Shave Cream Man, with stories rare. Take his advice and you'll look keen. You'll get a shave that's smooth and clean. You'll be a Colgate brushless fan.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Bill Stern with a 333rd edition of the Colgate Shave Cream Sports Newsreel, featuring strange and fantastic stories, some that are legends, others mere hearsay, but also interesting. We'd like to pass them along to you. Our guest tonight is the most famous baseball player of all time, the one and only Babe Ruth. But first, real one. Portrait of a strange beginning. This is a story that's so interesting that I'd like to tell it to you as it was told to me. This is the story of a hobo. Actually, he wasn't a hobo in the true sense of the word. His name was Harry. His family had given him a good education, but because Harry liked to roam and because he wouldn't stay home, he became a hobo as he drifted from one town to another. Shortly after the turn of the century, when our story opens, Harry had just run away from his home, and he found himself in Baltimore, Maryland. He was broke. When one day on the street, he happened to find a dollar bill. A dollar to Harry meant a great deal. It meant food and a place to sleep. But then, suddenly, Harry remembered something else. He remembered that in a Baltimore orphan asylum was a youngster who wanted more than anything else in the world to own a baseball bat. Harry had seen this youngster the day before, and the youngster told Harry how much he wanted a bat. For a while, Harry thought about the youngster and how much that baseball bat had meant to him. And then Harry thought about what he himself could do with that dollar he just found. He could buy a big, thick steak. He could get a place to sleep. Harry was torn between two emotions. He wanted to spend the dollar on himself, and yet somehow he kept seeing that pleading face of the poor orphan boy begging for the baseball bat. It didn't take Harry long to make his decision. He decided to go without food so that he might buy that baseball bat for his little friend in the orphan asylum. After that, according to the story, Harry drifted from one town to another until finally he found himself in Canada, traveling on a train. Only Harry didn't have any right to be on that train because Harry didn't have any ticket, nor did he have the money to buy one. And on the second day of that train trip, the conductor caught Harry. First, the conductor merely asked Harry where his ticket was. But when Harry couldn't produce either a ticket or the money to pay for one, the conductor ordered that train stopped, and he ordered Harry thrown off. After Harry was thrown off that train, he began to look around to see where he was at. He was 30 miles from the nearest town, and as he could plainly see, this part of Canada that he was in was wild and desolate. But Harry soon found out that food was plentiful and easy to get. So Harry decided to stay where he was, at least for the time being. One day, Harry made a curious discovery. For in searching for food, Harry discovered that certain rocks in the ground contained a brownish metal. Harry thought he knew what he'd stumbled onto, but he wanted to be sure. And after experimenting with those rocks, Harry was sure. He had discovered gold. Feverishly, Harry dug into the ground. The deeper he dug, the more gold he found. The Canadian government recognized Harry's claim, for he discovered gold on the spot where he'd been thrown off that train. And he became the second richest man in all of Canada. Such is the strange story of a former hobo named Harry. His full name was Harry Oakes. And his gold mine, which he did discover on the exact spot where he'd been thrown off that train, that gold mine gave him over $200 million. But remember when Harry was poor, when he was drifting around in Baltimore, Maryland, how the story said that he'd bought a baseball bat for a poor youngster in an orphan asylum? Well, that baseball bat inspired that youngster to take up the game. And this youngster liked the game of baseball so well that he went on to become the greatest ball player of all time, for his name was Babe Ruth. Babe Ruth will be with us in person in just a few minutes. That's why we told this story tonight. The story of the strange beginning of baseball's greatest player. Reel 2. If I were to write the story of the colorful manager of the Pittsburgh Pirates, I'd like to call it Flashing Through the Years with Frisch, because that expresses the tempo of Frankie Frisch, known in his playing days as the Fordham Flash. Maybe Frankie would reciprocate with a piece called Flashing Through a Shave with Colgate Brushless Shave Cream. As a matter of fact, Frankie recently wrote me,
"Dear Bill, I always envy those kids with beards like Peach Fuzz who could shave so fast with a no-brush cream. But I never dreamed a brushless shave cream could soften my tough whiskers until you got me to try Colgate Brushless. Honestly, Bill, that Colgate Brushless Shave Cream of yours gives me marvelously smooth, comfortable shaves with all the speed and convenience of no brushwork. Thanks a lot. Signed, Frankie Frisch."
You know, the part of that letter that I like best are those three words, "thanks a lot." I think you'll say thanks a lot, too, when you try Colgate Brushless Shave Cream. This is the shave cream of champions. The brushless cream made specially for you men with tough beards and naturally dry, sensitive skin. This is the shave cream made to give you more shaving comfort. Made to stay moist and active clear through your shave. Made to soften the toughest whiskers so your razor can chuck up a snag-free performance. And remember, Colgate Brushless isn't gummy or greasy. Rinses off your face and razor in a flash. Look, take my tip. Try Colgate Brushless Shave Cream. And if you're not completely satisfied, just send the top of the carton to me. Bill Stern, care of Colgate, Jersey City, Zone 2, New Jersey. And you'll get double your money back. Okay? Okay, then get a jumbo jar. That's the big 9-ounce economy-sized jar of Colgate Brushless Shave Cream. And get it tonight. Reel 3. Profile of last Sunday. Last Sunday was St. Patrick's Day. And because it was St. Patrick's Day, we're telling this legend tonight. For this is a St. Patrick's Day legend as told to me. This is the story of Stanley Ketchell. Stanley Ketchell was one of the greatest fighters who ever lived. He came blazing out of the West shortly after the turn of the century. He was rough. He was tough. In fact, Stanley Ketchell was one of the roughest fighters who ever fought in a prize ring. As long as any opponent stayed on his feet, Stanley Ketchell would tear into that opponent like a wild animal. He never showed any mercy to anyone. He was hated for what he did as he crippled man after man. Once in Cleveland, Ohio, on a St. Patrick's Day, according to the story, Stanley Ketchell fought an Irish youngster named Ernie Ball. Now, Ernie Ball was no match for the great Stanley Ketchell. And even though the fight was on a St. Patrick's Day and Ernie Ball was an Irishman, Stanley Ketchell proceeded to give Ernie Ball such a frightful beating that the youngster crumpled up on the floor in a bloody heap and he never fought again. However, it's really little wonder that Stanley Ketchell was able to beat Ernie Ball so badly. For Stanley Ketchell was rapidly becoming one of America's most famous prize fighters. He knocked out one man after another until finally, Stanley Ketchell became the middleweight champion of the world. Stanley Ketchell remained a ruthless fighter, even after he'd won the championship. A fighter who beat his opponents as badly as he could, until one day, at the very height of his career, Stanley Ketchell was murdered. The story of Stanley Ketchell's murder created a sensation. And after he was dead, the police went through his personal belongings. And in going through his effects, according to the story as told to me, they came upon a curious piece of paper. It was a letter written by Stanley Ketchell about a year before he was murdered. A letter that in effect read, "To whom it may concern. They've called me a ruthless fighter, a man without mercy." In most cases, that was true. Only once did I ever regret giving an opponent a bad beating. That once was back on a St. Patrick's Day in Cleveland, Ohio, when some of you may remember I fought an Irish youngster named Ernie Ball. And the only reason I'm sorry I beat him so badly is because I later found out that he wasn't a professional prize fighter at all. He was merely a youngster who was trying to get some money for an education. Thereby, I hereby direct whoever settles up my estate to please see that this youngster, Ernie Ball, gets $1,000. And I hope he uses this money for his education. Signed, Stanley Ketchell. Ernie Ball did use that money for an education. He immediately came to New York City where he began to study music until one day he wrote a song. A great song. The song became famous. So did Ernie Ball. And yet, according to this story, he might never have gotten to New York City. And he might never have written this song. But for a rough prize fighter named Stanley Ketchell in a prize fight that took place on St. Patrick's Day. But the strangest part of this story is that this song that Ernie Ball did write is the result of a prize fight held on St. Patrick's Day. That song became famous as a great St. Patrick's Day song, for that song was "When Irish Eyes Are Smiling."
Sure they steal your heart away.
Profile for great St. Patrick's Day song that, according to legend, began with a St. Patrick's Day prize. Real four. In just a moment, we'll present in person the most famous baseball player of all time, Babe Ruth. First, Arthur Gary.
Why do so many great sports stars go all out for Colgate Brushless Shave Cream? Why? Brother, they've proved that Colgate Brushless delivers the maximum in shaving comfort with a minimum of time and trouble, you betcha. Smooth on this light, fluffy cream. See how it softens the toughest whiskers. See how it stays moist, doesn't dry out. Gives your razor a grand assist for a close, clean, snag-free shave. See how Colgate Brushless Shave Cream rinses off razor and face jiffy quick because it's not gummy or greasy. That's champion performance, men. It's what you can expect every time you use Colgate Brushless, the shave cream of champions. So, buy yourself a jumbo jar tonight. And now, Bill Stern with his special guest, Babe Ruth.
Real five. Colgate's camera close-up of Babe Ruth. Here is the most famous baseball player of all time, the one and only Babe Ruth.
Bill, may I ask some questions, please?
On what, Babe?
On the story you just told.
Go right ahead.
Well, let's take the first story, the one about Harry Oakes and me.
Okay.
Are you sure that it was Harry Oakes who left that baseball bat for me at the orphan asylum?
Well, Babe, I wasn't there. I can only say that that was the story as told to me.
And how about being thrown off the train in Canada and finding a gold mine on the spot where he was thrown off?
Well, Babe, that story came from his own wife.
All right, let's go on to the second story.
Fire away, Babe.
Did Stanley Ketchel really give Ernie Ball the money that got Ernie Ball to New York?
Well, now, there are two versions of that, Babe. One version is that he was given the money by Ketchel, and the other version is he used the money he got from fighting Ketchel to get to New York.
But either way, it's amazing that a prize fighter should be responsible for the success of a tender song.
Yes, you're right, Babe. It is amazing. Now, if you don't mind, let me switch this around and ask you some questions. Who's going to win the American League pennant?
Why, the New York Yanks.
Oh, Babe, you might be prejudiced, but let's ask you who's going to win the National League pennant.
I think the St. Louis Cardinals.
Well, Babe, tell me this. What do you think of this new Mexican baseball league?
Why, it's mainly a lot of hot air.
Who's the greatest ball player playing baseball today?
Well, I think Ted Williams and Joe DiMaggio.
Who would you say was the greatest baseball team of all time?
I would say the Yanks of 1927, because on that team was Bob Musil, Tony Lazzari, Earl Coombs, Herb Pennock, and many others, and a good manager named Miller Huggins. And there was another player on that team by the name of Lou Gehrig.
Well, I
hope he is never forgotten.
Lou Gehrig was a great baseball player, but more than that, he was a great man. A man whose life was an inspiration to America. For on the day that Lou Gehrig died, a legend was born. No, he can never be forgotten.
Thanks so much. Good luck and good night, Babe Ruth. And that's the 3-0 mark for tonight. Next Friday night, we'll be back same time, same stations, with another edition of the Colgate Shave Cream Sports Newsreel. Our guest next Friday evening from Hollywood will be the lovely movie star, Miss Benita Granville. So be sure and be with us next Friday night at our usual time when we present as our guest the famous screen star, Benita Granville. See you then. And until then, I'll be seeing you on the screen in the News of the Day newsreel, on the screen in the News of the Day newsreel at your favorite Lowe's or Associated Theater. Now until this same time next Friday night when we greet you with our special guest, Benita Granville, this is Bill Stern for Colgate Shave Cream wishing you all a good, good night.
Bill Stern, the Colgate Shave Cream Man, is on his way. Bill Stern, the Colgate Shave Cream Man, had lots to say. He told you tales of sports heroes, the inside dope he really knows. So listen in next Friday night. C-O-L-G-A-T-E.
Ladies, your grocer would just love to send you all the soap you want. Sure he would. But he can't do that right now because the country's shortage of fat is keeping you short of soap. That's why, ladies, you're asked to save your used kitchen fat. Save it and sell it to your butcher for 4 cents a pound. So fill a tin and turn it in. The Bill Stern Show tonight came to you from New York City.
This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.
Stay tuned. We'll have the Fred Allen Show coming up shortly. But first, we're going to listen to a program called Can You Imagine That? And this is about motion pictures.
Motion pictures have never been made in Hollywood, California.
Bandits used barbed wire to rob a bank.
Dolly Madison was the only woman in private life to be accorded the privileges of the floor in the U.S. House of Representatives.
Can you imagine that? Once more, friends, this is Lindsay McCary bringing you another session of this series in which we try to amaze you with odd facts and unusual news stories from the past. We'll be back with you in just 1.5 minutes. Will you wait for us? Here's our first interesting item. It's really two in one because, well, just listen to the gentleman from Tennessee speaking on the floor of the U.S. House of Representatives on Jackson Day, January 8, 1844.
Oh, Mr. Speaker, what a colossal blot of shame rests upon this great government this day. This day, Mr. Speaker, we honor that great soldier and statesman, our revered and beloved 7th President of these United States, Andrew Jackson. Mr. Speaker, while we so do him this just honor, that grand old man of 77 years rests quietly in his home in Nashville, harassed by the shameful knowledge that this government has seen fit one horrible day to levy a fine of $1,000 upon him for contempt of court, but really for the assiduous execution of his faithful duty as he saw it.
Will the gentleman from Tennessee yield?
I yield to the gentleman from North Carolina.
Mr. Speaker, I've just noticed a beloved person sitting in the gallery of this house, a woman whose memory shall ever be revered by this nation because of her heroic acts 32 years ago, in saving from the hands of an enemy one of our most precious historic documents, the Declaration of Independence. Of course, I refer to Mrs. Dolly Payne Madison, widow of our fourth president. I move you that a committee be appointed on the part of this House to wait on Mrs. Madison and to assure her that whenever it shall be her pleasure to visit the house, she be requested to take a seat within the hall.
Thus did the United States House of Representatives honor 74-year-old Dolly Madison, widow of James Madison, by according her the privileges of the floor of the House. Up to the present writing, Dolly Madison is the only woman in private life who has ever been accorded this honor. Can you imagine that? It was also during that same year, 1844, that Congress ordered Andrew Jackson's $1,000 contempt of court fine to be repaid with interest. The aged ex-president later received a U.S. government warrant to the amount of $2,700. You've often heard the expression, you can drive a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. Well, from a newspaper of more than 35 years ago comes this story. Mr. Charles Cott was driving his horse and wagon down a street in Chicago on a cold, wintry mid-December day. Perhaps Mr. Cott had a little early Christmas spirit. At any rate, as he drove along...
Up today's the other way we go to la da 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 da. Oh, look, just look, there's good old Quigley's Saloon. I gotta stop and have a little drink. Steady, boy. Steady. You know, there's nothing like a little drink on a cold December day. No, sir. Now, you wait here, boy. You wait here, and I'll be right up. Oh, no. No, you don't have to wait here. You're coming with me. Horses got to get warm inside, too. And I'll get you unharnessed here. You and me will have a little drink of good old Quickly Saloon. Now, come on. Won't old Quigley be surprised? Come on, let's go. Come on. What'd you say? What? Oh, yes, you do want a drink. Now, come on. Don't be stubborn. You can have a little drink with me. Come on, now. You can have a drink, I tell you. Oh, come on.
Mr. Cott's horse did not enter Quigley's for the little drink, but Mr. Cott did enter court the next day, charged with disturbing the peace. Perhaps the judge was an animal fancier, for his sentence was...
Charles Cott, I appreciate the motives, but not the method. I'm going to let you off, though, and fine you merely the court cost. But hereafter, don't try to drag your horse into a saloon.
So did Charles Cott of Chicago learn the full force of the old proverb, you can drive a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. Can you imagine that? The ultimate in bank robbery stories comes from a newspaper of January 2, 1909. It seems that in Wellston, Oklahoma, some of the townspeople were surprised to see... Ah, but listen.
Hey, what's the idea over there by the bank? Look.
Hey, what's going on? I didn't hear nothing about them building a barbed wire fence around the place. What do you suppose the idea?
I don't know. Well, that's... Hey, look, them fellas building the fence have got guns.
Well, yeah. Well, some of them are scattering along the fence. That's a holdup.
Darned if it ain't. Them fellas built that fence to hold us off while they robbed the bank. Get the rest of the boys, quick. Get them.
While the citizens of Wellston were kept at bay by the robbers within the enclosure formed by the fence, the robbers worked on the vault, and suddenly...
They done it. They blew the vault.
And here they come. Look out.
The robbers got away after a running gun battle, and with them went $5,000 from the vault of the Bank of Wellston. And this robbery remains the first and only case I can find of bank robbers actually building a fence around the bank and then proceeding calmly to rob the bank while some of them held off the townspeople by means of a barbed wire fence and bullets. Can you imagine that? Mr. James Artlip of Aurora, Illinois, likes the movies. Oh, you don't think that's new, huh? Well, Mr. Artlip is 68 years old. And on February 24th, 1939, he saw his first movie. When interviewed, said the newest fan of Hollywood's make-believe...
Yes, sir, I think they got something there. I sure do like them. Honestly, it's just marvelous. Pictures actually move on the screen, and you can hear the actors talk.
You like them, huh?
You bet I do. I think I'll go see another one sometime.
Well, why have you taken so long to get to a movie, Mr. Artlip?
I just never got around to it before. I pass four theaters every day, but I just never thought about going into one.
Well, what made you go in this time?
Why, I saw it was a picture about Jesse James. Thought I might just as well see it, because I read a book about him.
So chalk up another conquest for Hollywood and the flickering photos, even though it did take them 68 years to win Mr. James Artlip. Can you imagine that? Do you remember this startling statement at the beginning of the program?
Motion pictures have never been made in Hollywood, California.
Well, like our others, that statement is true. Why? Because there is no such recognized town or city of Hollywood, California. It wasn't until the year 1910 that the motion picture producers realized that their needs for strong lighting could be filled by the brilliant Southern California sunshine and came to that region to build their first studios. They settled in the portion of the city of Los Angeles which had been the town of Hollywood. But in that same year, 1910, previous to the arrival of these first movie magnates, the town of Hollywood had already been annexed to the city of Los Angeles. And so our statement is true...
Motion pictures have never been made in Hollywood, California.
Can you imagine that? Well, now let's do a little foraging into the field of melody sleuthing. First of all, I want you to listen to a semi-classic selection, which I'm sure you've heard before many, many times. The orchestra is going to play only a few measures, so listen carefully. And as you listen, try to recollect the name of the number itself and also the more modern popular number which this semi-classic selection most resembles. Are you ready? All right, listen. What was the name of that selection?
Oh, I remember that, Lindsay. It's Cavatina by the famous German composer Joseph Joachim Raff.
That's right. Raff's Cavatina. Well, now, among all of you here assembled, did anyone recognize it as the possible foundation of one of our most popular hits of a few years ago?
I think I did, Lindsay.
All right, what is it?
My Baby's Arms.
And that is also correct. My Baby's Arms. Listen now, ladies and gentlemen, and see whether or not there is a distinct similarity between Raff's Cavatina and that smash hit from the Ziegfeld Follies of 1919, My Baby's Arms. You have it once more, friends. One more session of Can You Imagine That? We all hope you'll be listening on the same station when next we're scheduled to meet. Until that time, this is Lindsay McCary turning you over to the very good care of your own station announcer and saying goodbye now.
Can You Imagine That? From 1940. Now it's time for the Fred Allen Show and Scalping Baseball Tickets from 1948.
The Ford Dealers of America present the Fred Allen Show. Show with Fred's guests Leo DeRocha, Portland Hoffa, Minerva Pius, Peter Donald, Parker Fenley, the DeMarco sisters, and Al Goodman and his orchestra. And this is Kenny Delmar speaking for your friendly Ford dealer. He's the expert on Fords in your neighborhood. He's the one who knows your Ford best. It stands to reason that he's the man to service your Ford. He has special equipment to do the job right. His mechanics are Ford trained in factory approved methods. He has genuine Ford parts. So for an expert job done promptly, it pays to bring your Ford back home for service.
Ladies and gentlemen, to observe daylight saving time, today all clocks were moved ahead 1 hour. Tonight, we bring you the man of the hour. The hour the country lost. He's Fred Allen.
Thank you, and good evening, ladies and gentlemen. And Portland, I'm glad you mentioned that mildly amusing bit that you did about daylight saving time.
When the clocks are moved ahead, does that make everybody an hour younger?
An hour younger? Yes, it does. If you had a grandfather clock and you moved it ahead enough hours, the grandfather clock would become a little boy clock with a small face and dirty hands. You'd have to move it ahead an awful lot.
Daylight.
Now wait, just because your lines don't get last, you know.
Daylight saving spoiled Mama's cuckoo clock.
Really? How?
The cuckoo doesn't know what time it is.
Really? What makes you think so?
Today at 12 o'clock, the cuckoo came out and just shrugged its wings.
If you think you're... I saw a man come out of the Audubon Society and do the same thing. I think he was cuckoo too, but he... If you think your cuckoo is confused, you should see Misha Auer today. He doesn't even know who he is. Say, I just happened... We have awfully slow acoustics in here. I must speak to Mr. Trammell to have the acoustics stepped up in here. Say, Portland, I just happened to think, Jack Eigen.
What is that?
Well, Jack Eigen only listens to our program until he hears his name. Now, he asked me to mention his name early tonight. He has to go over to the circus. He's doing a special broadcast from inside Gargantua's cage. After the show, Gargantua is going over to the Copa, I think, for Jack's anniversary. It looks like a big night with fur on at the Copa tonight. Tell me, Portland. Wait till I get Gargantua to check his coat. Wait till they try. Tell me, Portland, what's in the news this week?
The subway fare is going to be raised to 10 cents.
I wonder why they're raising the subway fare.
Well, Mama says they're trying to keep out the riffraff.
Well, they should. The subway really could use a better class of people.
It's going to cost 10 cents to come from Jackson Heights.
And it's going to be worth it.
Have you heard the new subway jingle?
Really? What is the subway jingle?
The subway fare is now a dime. Commuters think it is a crime. The good old days are forever lost when a ride in the subway only cost a nickel, 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 nickel.
That's
nickel,
very
nickel.
Good. That's very good. You are in rare voice tonight.
Do you think I'll ever sing at the Met?
Not inside, no. Tell me, what else is hot in the news?
Well, Kathleen Windsor, who wrote Forever Amber, is divorcing her husband, Artie Shaw.
Yeah, they say she's writing a sequel to Forever Amber.
A sequel?
It's called Temporarily Artie. I don't hear any cries... I don't hear any cries of author, author from people waiting to wanting the name of the man who wrote that joke. I think I shall start for Allen's Alley.
What is your question tonight?
Well, a new book called The Treasury of American Superstitions has been compiled by Claudia DeLise. It contains every superstition you have ever heard of, Portland. And so, being in the mood for superstitions, our question is, how do you feel about superstitions?
Shall we go?
As the Chinese teapot said to the auctioneer's hammer, I'm going, going, I'm gone. It's good to get back to Allen's Alley, Portland. I guess the Senator's having mule meat for dinner. There's something braying in the barbecue pit. Oh, well, let's not.
Somebody tap my trellis. Oh, it's you, Jughead.
Yes, Senator.
Well, let's go, son. As the two men said when they was inventing bubble gum, let's make it snappy.
But,
you know, I'm busier than a handkerchief during a Betty Davis picture. I'm working on Senator Taft's housing bill. Everybody today is trying to get into a new house.
But,
even Senator Taft.
Senator Taft is trying to get into a new house?
Yeah, the White House. You don't get it, do you, son?
No.
You ought to give your head to a bone bank.
Now, wait a minute. Wait a minute, sir. Take it easy with those innuendos, Senator. Tell me, what's new?
Well, I was up in New York attending that newspaper publisher's convention.
The newspaper?
Confidentially, son. Don't let this get around.
No.
I never read the newspapers, only the funnies.
The comics, eh?
Yeah, my favorite is Joe Palooka.
Joe Palooka,
When I was a young sprout, I used to dress like Joe Palooka.
Yeah?
Used to talk like Joe Palooka.
Yeah?
Used to walk like Joe Palooka.
Gosh.
When I'd strut down the street, everybody would say, there goes that Palooka.
And they can still say that today, Senator.
I'm honored, son.
Well, tell me, Senator, how do you feel about American superstition?
Well, son, down where I come from, we've got one superstition.
And that superstition is?
That a drink of whiskey will cure a snake bite.
I see.
For 20 years, every morning when I get up, I drink a full tumbler of whiskey.
Every morning?
Every noon before dinner, I drink another full tumbler of whiskey.
Every noon?
Every night before going to bed, I drink a full tumbler of whiskey.
You've been drinking whiskey for 20 years? Have you ever been bitten by a snake, Senator?
Not yet, son.
No?
But the first snake that bites me is going to find me well prepared. So long. So long.
I hope the snake is as well fortified as the senator. Yeah, I wonder if Mr. Moody's around.
Howdy, Bob.
Mr. Moody, you look a little tired.
Yeah, last night I was up till all hours.
Oh, really?
Must have been 9 o'clock before I got to bed. And then this morning I didn't wake up till 5 o'clock.
5 o'clock?
Well, the whole forenoon was gone.
What kept you up so late?
Oh, our Townsend Club had a do.
Oh, really? What was the entertainment?
The first act was a feller in yellow bell brigands and bare feet.
An acrobat?
He kept skinning the cat for 20 minutes.
Oh, I see.
Next, two fellas come on dressed in blood-red tuxedos.
Yes?
They played Chinatown, My Chinatown on musical bottles.
Say, this was some show.
The grand howdy-do and climax was Miss Mona Huckabee.
Yeah?
Miss Huckabee, she gave an exciting description of a honeysuckle bloom unfolding and opening up that she'd spied on through a magnifying glass.
Say, you had some evening.
I'd think twice before I'd go through it again.
Mr. Moody, what about these American superstitions?
Why, some of them make sense, some don't.
Well, how do you mean?
Well, some people think keeping a whale in a closet is bad luck.
Yes, that's true.
And a family I know, they wouldn't open an umbrella in the house. They said that was bad luck.
Really?
One spring it rained, 32 straight days and nights.
Yeah?
Rain started pouring through the roof down inside the house.
They wouldn't raise an umbrella?
No. Whole family was drowned.
What do you mean? Well, tell me, Titus, do you have any superstitions?
Why, I ain't decided.
No?
Last summer, I nailed a horseshoe up over my front door to bring me good luck. And it did.
What happened?
Why, one night, lightning struck the metal horseshoe.
Yes?
My house burnt to the ground.
But how were you lucky?
I wasn't home. So long.
Oh, wow. Let's try this next door.
Howdy, Jeffy.
Mrs. Nussbaum, I see you have your gold wedgies on.
I'm practically only now this minute from the theater returning.
Really? What play did you see?
Macbeth. It is written by Jake Spear.
Are you a Shakespeare fan?
When I am attending by Mrs. Bibberman, the finishing school, a young chit.
Uh-huh.
I'm starting with the dramatics club in Macbeth.
Oh, really? What part did you play in Macbeth?
With long hair, also one tooth, I am a witch.
Oh, a witch?
Doubling, toil with troubling, fire, brain, also cauldron, bobbling.
From the play of the same name. That's very good.
Mrs. Bibberman is saying, with closing the eyes, you are not knowing me from Morris Evans.
I can say that. Well, Mrs. Nussbaum, how do you feel about superstitions?
Oh, walking under a mirror, breaking a ladder, throwing over the shoulder saltines, I'm laughing.
Do you recall any specific instances where you have flouted superstition?
Last October.
What happened?
It's an old superstition. A black cat is crossing the path. It's coming bad luck.
Bad luck.
With Pierre, I am out driving.
Yes?
Is crossing the path. Three black cats.
Three black cats?
We are hitting them. One, two, three.
And the bad luck?
The black cat is having the bad luck.
And you?
I am having a new fur coat.
Oh, my God. And that brings us to the Ajax Cassidy, Sandy. Let's pass the time of day with Mr. Cassidy.
Here we are. We're not going to be doing it. We're not going to be doing it.
Well, Mr. Cassidy, what about these superstitions?
My boy, superstitions are not to be taken lightly.
No?
When the supernatural is flaunted, dire are the consequences that can ensue.
You know of a specific case, eh, Jack?
I do. 'Twas three on a match put Balzac Brannigan in the hospital.
Three on a match?
Well, now, you see, Balzac was at the circus.
Yes?
And the Siamese twins was just lighting two cigarettes.
Uh-huh.
Balzac stepped up and asked the Siamese twins for a light.
I see.
Well, after he got the light, Balzac started to walk between the Siamese twins. He was stopped.
I see.
Balzac says, "Whatever it is, let it down, boys. I've got to get through."
Let it... Yeah?
Well, a fight started.
Yes?
One of the Siamese twins was arrested, the other one got away, and Balzac came to in the accident ward.
Say, there must be something to those superstitions.
Oh, there is. Now, you take Knocko Nolan, the waiter.
What happened to Knocko, the waiter?
Well, now, all his life, to ward off rheumatism, yeah? Knocko carried an acorn in his pocket.
An acorn?
When he finally died, Knocko, the waiter, was buried in his waiter suit with the acorn still in his pocket.
Uh-huh.
20 years later, what happened?
What?
Out of Knocko, the waiter's grave, there grew a giant oak tree.
A giant oak tree.
And the oak tree had on a tuxedo coat and a dickie.
Are you superstitious, Ajax?
Oh, I am, me boy. I'm convinced the number 13 is unlucky.
What makes you think so?
Well, 13 has caused me to disappear at frequent intervals for periods of 30 days.
13?
12 jurymen and a judge. Good night.
We've had enough fun. Is ready now for the DeMarco song. And so, the five DeMarco sisters and Maestro Goodman add up to April showers, girl.
Showers, they come your way. They bring the flowers that bloom in May. So if it's raining, have no regret, because it isn't raining rain. You know it's raining violet. And when you see clouds up on the hill, you soon will see crowds of daffodils. So keep on looking for a bluebird and listening for its song whenever April showers come along. When you see clouds up in the hills, soon you see crowds. So many daffodils in the hills, so look for a bluebird and listen for its song whenever April showers come along. When April showers come along. And
now, ladies and gentlemen...
Oh, Fred.
Yes, Kenny?
Senator Claghorn is outside to see you.
Senator Claghorn? I just left him a little while ago. Send him in.
All right. Right this way, Senator.
Yes, come right in, Senator Claghorn.
Well, howdy. Say howdy, son. Have a cigar.
Well, thanks, Senator. Say, what's the big idea carrying that tree trunk with you?
Well, son, I'm aiming to make some stump speeches. I'm campaigning.
Campaigning? Oh, that explains this free cigar, then. Say, what's this writing on the band? A vote for Claghorn is a vote for Ford trucks.
Yeah, that's my slogan, son. It's sweeping the country.
The new Ford trucks?
They're drawing the crowd, son. Everybody wants that bonus.
You are giving a bonus?
Ford trucks are giving the bonus. They're bonus built. Built extra strong to last longer, that is.
Well, tell me, Senator, isn't this something new in politics, building a platform around trucks?
Well, son, when I heard there were 139 models in the new Ford truck line, I started thinking.
Thinking what?
When I heard how truck drivers were raving about the comfort of Ford's new million-dollar cab, I made up my mind.
You're setting up campaign headquarters at your Ford dealer?
I'm doing better than that, son. I'm turning in my old bandwagon for a new Ford truck. So long, son. So long, Senator.
So long. For listeners who feel that a little music goes a long way, we have just offered a few bars of But Beautiful, played by Maestro Al Goodman and his They Knew Vaughn Monroe When He Was Only a Schmo Orchestra. And now, ladies, yes, Portland?
Who is our guest tonight?
Well, we haven't any guest, Portland.
No guest?
That is one of the things that is wrong with radio today. Every program has refrigerators and guests.
But guests are
radio has too many guests. I heard a guest on Mary Margaret McBride's program the other day. He brought a guest with him. Well, while Mary was interviewing her guest, the guest was interviewing his guest. It was very confusing. Mr. Bohack objected, I heard later.
But last week, you said Leo DeRocher was coming tonight.
Leo DeRocher is the reason I am finished with guests, Portland. The trouble I had with that Leo DeRocher.
What happened?
Well, last Thursday, I was walking along 50th Street. Just as I passed Peg Woffington's tea shop, the door opened, and I heard a voice say...
Hello, Fred.
Leo DeRocher. Leo, what are you doing coming out of Peg Woffington's tea shop?
I just finished my lesson.
Your lesson in a tea shop?
Yes, I have a tutor. I'm studying the theory and proper technique of drinking tea.
Tea?
Fred, do you know when you finish your tea, you're not supposed to squeeze the wet tea bag out between your fingers?
No? What do you do?
Well, when you're finished, you pick the tea bag up in the sugar tongs and press it gently.
But, Leo...
Fred, do you know what I learned today?
What?
You drink tea out of the cup.
The cup? What do you do with the saucer?
Well, if your tea is too hot to drink, you fan it with your saucer.
Oh, wait a minute, Leo. Leo, what is this tea routine?
Well, you have to know these things, old boy, when you're in the literary set.
You are in the literary set?
Yes, Fred. I just wrote a book.
A book?
It's called The Dodgers and Me.
The Dodgers and Me.
Well, in Boston, of course, it's called The Dodgers and I.
Oh, naturally. But, Leo, how did you ever happen to write a book?
Well, last year, Fred, I had a lot of time on my hands. And I read that Babe Ruth was writing a book, and it gave me an idea.
Oh, so you started to write a book, too?
I wrote day and night for 6 months.
And when you finished?
I had a sentence 300 pages long.
One sentence was 300 pages long?
The publisher made me go back and break it up into paragraphs. Then he showed me what periods, commas, and hyphens were, and told me to punctuate it.
And when the book was finished?
I had 200 commas, 30 periods, and one hyphen left over.
One hyphen, eh?
I finally got rid of the hyphen.
How?
I stood the hyphen up on end and used it for an exclamation point.
Good.
Well, Fred, I must dash. I'll be late for my etiquette class.
Etiquette class?
Oh, yes. Attending all these literary teas, I can't afford to commit a faux pas.
Oh, you're polishing your manners?
Oh, I'm also learning my knives and forks.
Oh, fine.
Fred... You know that little fork way down at the end of the forks?
Yes.
That's for eating oysters.
No kidding. An oyster fork?
For 30 years, I've been eating oysters with a spoon.
Gosh.
Last night, my homework was correct napkin usage.
Correct napkin usage.
The napkin is supposed to be unfurled and tossed casually on the lap.
Oh.
I used to stuff my napkin down in my collar.
Oh, and now that your napkin is in your lap?
My shirt is loaded with gravy.
You're a mess, eh?
Well, I'm a slob, but I'm correct.
Leo, take my advice. Stay a slob. What do you want with etiquette and writing books? Why, you're one of the best managers in baseball.
Ah, but I'm thinking of my future, Fred. That's why I became an author.
Why?
Well, George Bernard Shaw is 92 years old, and he's still writing, isn't he?
Yes.
When a baseball player is 92, where is he?
Where?
He's pitching for the Giants.
Leo, I wonder if you...
I'll be glad to, Fred. I'll have my publisher, Ziff Davis, send you a copy of my book, The Dodgers and Me, tomorrow.
No, not the book, Leo. I know the Dodgers are playing at Ebbets Field. I thought you might have a ticket.
Oh, it just so happens I have two extra tickets. Eugene O'Neill couldn't make it. Here you are, Fred.
Gosh, two tickets. Thanks a lot, Leo.
Well, I'm having a beret made. I've got to get a fitting. So long, Fred.
So long, Leo. Well, Portland, the next day I took the two tickets and went over to Brooklyn to see the game. I got out of the subway. I seemed to be in the very heart of Brooklyn. Natives crowded around me in their quaint costumes, chattering in a strange tongue. I stopped a native girl and said, "Pardon me." The native girl replied,
"What's eating you, Jake?"
Can you tell me, miss, can you tell me how to get to Ebbets Field?
Ebbets Field?
Yes.
Latch on.
Uh-huh.
This is my landing place.
Yeah.
You get down first, you see an oyster bar.
Uh-huh.
Cross the oyster bar is a moon pitcher.
Yeah.
Next to moon pitcher's tide.
Yeah.
Go down tide, 30 blocks. That's 30 tide and tide. That's Ebbets Field.
Well, I know, but where is Ebbets Field?
Oh, you refugees.
Now, look. Look, miss. Miss, by any chance, are you going? You going towards Ebbets Field?
I noted a wolf in creep's clothing.
Now, miss, miss, I have an extra ticket to the game. If you'd like
oh,
to.
Oh yeah, I'm calling a cop.
Come back here, miss. Never. Miss, I have an extra ticket.
Pardon,
I have it.
Pardon me, mister.
Yes, sir.
I heard you yelling. Are you selling tickets for the Dodgers game?
No, not selling. No, I just happen to have an extra ticket here.
I'll give you $5 for it.
Oh no, I couldn't take your money.
But I insist.
No, here, you take the ticket.
Here's the $5. So long.
No, wait. Come here, I don't want your money.
Look. You there, just a minute.
Yes, officer.
You got a license to sell baseball tickets?
A license? No.
I thought so, a scalper.
A scalper?
That's the joke, copper. He tried to give me the eye.
Ah, molest him, too. All right, come on, Chisler.
But, officer, I can explain.
Tell it to the judge.
But I'm going to Ebbets Field.
Oh, yeah?
I'm Leo DeRoche's guest. He invited me to see his team.
Never mind the team. I'm calling the wagon. Come on!
Now, wait. Take your cold hand out of my collar, officer. You're chilling my Adam's apple, officer. And I... Well, Portland, the next morning I had to go to court. I called Leo DeRocher and he came over to be my witness. We got to the Brooklyn court just in time. The judge was rapping his gavel.
Hear yours. The next case. Next case. People of Brooklyn versus Fred Allen. The charge, ticket speculating. Guilty or not guilty, Allen?
Not guilty, Your Honor.
That's what you think. Wait till I get going. All right, who's the first witness?
Judge.
What's your name?
Shirley Heffelfinger.
What happened, Shirley?
Well, Your Honor, I'm standing on Myrtle Avenue when Miss Geronimo give me the eye. Well, I throw him the chill. The next thing I know, he's hawking tickets to the Dodgers game.
Your Honor, this is ridiculous.
Order in the court! Officer Clancy.
I caught him two-handed, Your Honor.
Two-handed?
In one hand, he had a ticket. In the other hand, he was holding $5.
Where's the evidence, Clancy?
Right here. Here's the stub of the ticket.
Clancy, how was the game?
Oh, great. And here's the change, Miss $5. I had 17 hot dogs.
Allen, this evidence is incriminating.
Your Honor, I can explain.
Order in the court! Whereas, you open your trap once more, I'll throw me gravel in it. Now, wait a minute. Don't talk back. You New York wise guys has got to quit coming over here trying to smirch the good name of Brooklyn.
But, Your Honor...
Last week, a guy in a parking lot had a television set on top of a beer barrel. He was simulating a saloon. Now you come over with your ticket speculating. I ought to habeas your corpus. But,
Your Honor, I have a witness.
All right, where's your witness?
He's right here. Tell the judge, Leo.
Your Honor, I feel that the prosecution of this innocent man is a grave miscarriage of justice.
Hey, just a moment, character. Who are you?
I'm Leo DeRocher.
What's on your mind, bud?
Well, I'd like to say a few words on Mr. Allen's behalf.
Yes, tell the judge just what happened, Leo.
Yeah, no perjury, neither.
Well, Your Honor, the quality of mercy is not strained. It droppeth as the gentle rain from heaven.
What is that, a weather report?
Your Honor, that's from The Merchant of Venice.
I don't care if it's from Abraham and Strauss. This Allen's a Delta ticket.
Your Honor?
Tell him where I got the tickets, Leo.
Your Honor, I gave Mr. Allen those baseball tickets.
What are you, a printer?
Oh, you're a writer.
You're a writer? Oh, Clancy.
Yeah, Your Honor.
I think I got this bum trapped. Give him a pencil and paper.
Okay, Judge.
All right, Mr. Writer. Now write something.
Gladly, Your Honor. There you are.
Hey, look, Clancy, what is this?
It's writing, Judge.
No kidding. I thought writing was bigger than that.
No, Judge, that's writing.
All right, Mr. Wise Guy, you wrote it. Now read it. What does it say?
It says, The Dodgers and Me, on sale May 18th at all bookshops.
How'd you hear that, Judge? The Dodgers are for sale.
Yeah, that does it. Alan is scalping tickets, and this con man is trying to sell the Dodgers. Clancy, hand me reservation book for Sing Sing.
Your Honor, this is ridiculous. Leo, tell him who you really are.
But Fred, my literary standing.
But Leo, Sing Sing.
Oh, all right. Your Honor, I'm manager of the Brooklyn Dodgers.
What did you say your name was again?
DeRocher. Leo DeRocher.
Leo DeRocher. How long you been managing the Dodgers?
9 years.
Oh, yeah? Where was you last year?
Well, it's a long story, Judge. Part of the time, I was writing a book.
And you say this year you're managing the Dodgers?
Yes, Your Honor.
Better you should start writing another book.
What do you mean?
Well, what happened last Wednesday? The Giants beat us. What's the big idea, using 24 men?
Well, the Dodgers had a bad day, Your Honor.
Why don't you fix the lineup?
What's wrong with the lineup?
Well, you got Ward on first, Robinson on second, Cox on third.
What lineup would you use?
Well, first I put Stanky on second.
Stanky's in Boston.
What's Stanky doing in Boston? The Dodgers is playing in Brooklyn.
We sold Stanky to Boston.
Brooklyn sold Stanky? Would the Mine Workers Union sell John L. Lewis?
I'm not managing the Mine Workers Union.
Well, anyway, there's one consolation. We still got Dixie Walker.
Judge, haven't you heard?
Leo, you didn't.
Dixie was sold to Pittsburgh.
Leo, do we still have 9 men left?
What do you think we're playing with? You knucklehead bat boys.
Okay, Leo, but let's get them organized. Maybe we won't win the pennant, but at least we won't fall out of the league.
Hey, Judge, Your Honor, what about my trial?
Quiet. The court's busy trying to save the Dodgers. Now, Leo, here's your lineup.
All right, Judge, who's on first?
Now, what's on first?
That's what I said. Who's on first?
Who's on second? What's on first?
Your Honor, what about me?
You're on third. Now, listen, Leo. Quiet, don't you?
This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.
That's all we have time for today, but we'll be back next week with more old-time radio for you. Till then, this is Jim Dolan thanking you for listening.